So at this grand kind of theoretical level of what marriage is all about, I would like to just say a few things about social institutions and the whole idea of social institution, that marriage is a social institution, and we need things other than simply the legal and political sector and the economic or market sector. In economics, we always think about the public and the private, which roughly means the market is the private sector and the government is the public sector. And there's a whole bunch of the world out there that doesn't really fit neatly into either of those categories. And as economists, we like to try to shove them into one category or the other. So everything turns out to be the market. If it's not government, we just shove it into the market. Well, there's another whole sector out there, which is the social or the cultural, okay, which really isn't exactly a contract, isn't really the market, and is certainly not political. And so you have to have some mental space to think about that part of society, or you're going to end up doing what my husband and I did, having separate bank accounts or thinking we were slaves of the state or something. You know, we just had this very strange dichotomy of how the world works. And the point is that each of these three sectors, the legal-political, the market, economic, and the social-cultural, each of them has their own distinct roles to play. Each of them has their own strengths and weaknesses, and you really can't do a society without all three. That's really the point. And I think we're finding that out as the family gets squeezed from both sides, both from the market and from the political sector. Now, a key fact about social institutions is that it's more than simply a collection of individuals. It's not just an aggregation of individuals. The social institutions are important precisely because they perform some kind of team production, and you can't just say, oh, this part's yours and this part's mine, and privatize the whole thing, as my husband and I were trying to do with our bank accounts and that. And it's also the case, at least in the Anglo-American tradition, that social institutions can have a legal identity, which is separate from the identity of the members within it, and actually social institutions can outlive their members. And the example of this actually would be the business corporation. If you think about it, a corporation has a legal identity. When you go to work for a corporation, you don't lose your legal identity, but there is a real social reality there, which is the business firm. There is a social reality here called the Institute for Marriage and Family Canada. It's a separate entity. It's not just a collection of contracts. It's not just a bunch of individuals working together. There's something bigger than the sum of the parts. And I would argue that marriage is such an institution, that marriage has this very kind of form, that the production or the product or the output of marriage, if you like, is children, which is obviously a team effort, right? It's obviously a joint product, even though a lot of our modern artificial reproductive technology is trying to convince us otherwise. You actually do need two people to make a child. And for sure, you need two people to raise a child, to get them from the zygote stage to the tax-paying stage. You know, there's a lot of effort that goes in between, and it requires some joint effort. Men and women come together spontaneously. It's not a creation of the state. You know, you don't really need too much coaxing to get men and women to do this, you know. And it solves problems, many problems, solves them much more personally and much more intimately and with much greater care than either the state or the market can do. And I'm sure in our talk this afternoon about childcare, we're going to hear something about this, that it's not just the state that can't do it. It's also the market that's not exactly able to do it. It's the personal touch that the mother and father can bring to the child that's distinct from anything that these other sectors can do. And then finally, we should just point out that the cooperation between a mother and a father is the most basic unit of social cooperation in any society. You know, economists like contracts because we think of that as a form of cooperation. And so it is. It is a form of cooperation. But it's not the only form of cooperation. That's the point. There are lots of ways that people can cooperate. And it's a mistake to shove it all into that one category. Now, I'd like to say briefly why I think marriage is actually more than a contract, why that idea we have in our minds that it's just a contract, why there's something wrong with that, okay? And you can look at it both from the top down or from the bottom up. As a contract, if you think about the theory of contracts, it's a very funny contract because you can't possibly specify it completely. It's not like a contract that Dave made with the catering company here, where you know exactly where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to provide, and what you're supposed to give back in return. The rights and responsibilities within a marriage are far too numerous to enumerate and to write down. Okay, and in fact, if you try to do that, if you tried to say, I do this for you, you do that for me, what are you going to do? You're going to undermine the actual basis of cooperation that's implied in the marriage, right? Because you're going to be keeping score on each other, right? You're going to be keeping track of each other. The idea that you should be partners with each other is going to get lost as you're trying to make sure that the other person's, by golly, doing their share, you know? So the better analogy is really to think of marriage as, if you're going to use any analogy from business, which you don't have to, but if you're going to use an analogy from business, the partnership would be a better one than a contract, but, you know, because a partnership is a more open-ended relationship where you're working together for a long period of time for a project and you're both invested in the outcome. Whereas a contract, if you think about it, has a much more limited scope. Typically, and there's a whole theory within economics about when you use contracts versus when you have when you create a social institution called a business firm versus when you just go buy things on the market. There's a whole theory about that. So I'm just hinting at that stuff. But for now, I just want you to understand that thinking of marriage simply as a contract does not do justice to the complexity of the interaction that the people are having, and that it's a mistake to think you can reduce it all to a contract. So it's for sure that there's a contractual basis for marriage, but there's much more going on as well. And this particular point is something that I develop at length in Chapter 4 of Love and Economics. The chapter is called Why Marriage is Not a Contract, and just goes through some of these arguments in some detail if that's of interest to you. Okay, so that's the big picture of why it is that viewing marriage as a contract and just a piece of paper, why that doesn't really quite work. Okay, why there's something bigger involved here. Now we want to spend a few minutes exploding myths about cohabitation and marriage. Now, in my judgment, from studying a lot of evidence on this subject, modern opinion makers have systematically overstated to people the risks associated with marriage. Okay, that whole list of things that we started off with are a list of things which are risks associated with marriage, but they have been overstated in a systematic way. They have understated the risks or the costs associated with cohabitation, and so therefore people are coming to the conclusion that cohabitation is a good deal because they've got this kind of skewed information with which they're making a decision. So this phenomenon of cohabitation has been extensively studied, and I'm going to give you a kind of an overview of the general results. And then I'm going to allude to just a few very, very recent studies to give you an idea that these are not results that went away 10 years ago or something like that. And when I say that these are robust results, what I mean is that the phenomenon has been extensively studied and you keep getting the same kind of answer study after study. Okay, that's what I'm going to be. I'm not going to report fluky stuff to you. I'm going to tell you that there have been hundreds of studies by now, I would say hundreds of studies, on the phenomenon of cohabitation. And what I'm going to report is basically the big picture of what comes out of those results. This general reference is something that I would recommend strongly to you. Most of the general results that I get here are based on this study. It was done in 2002. This was a comprehensive review of the literature as of 2002. And their conclusion, you see there at the bottom, no positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. And that's still true. That is still true. There is no positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage. It's never been found. And if you're interested in getting this general reference, you can download it free on the website of the National Marriage Project. So when I speak in generalities, it'll be based on this report. And then I have a few studies that have come out since 2002 to just bring you a little bit more recent information on the same topic. Okay, myth number one, marriage is dangerous to women and children. Okay, it's usually presented as it's dangerous to women, but the subtext is that, well, it's probably dangerous for kids too. Marriage is just dangerous, okay? The fact is that cohabitation is more dangerous to women and children than marriage. Okay? So when you say marriage is dangerous, compared to what is the question? All right? Domestic violence against women is much more prevalent in cohabiting relationships than in marriage. Women in cohabiting relationships are more likely to suffer physical and sexual abuse. Most studies show that aggression now is at least twice as common among cohabitors as among married couples. And then finally, a couple of studies from the 90s, one done on Canadian data, one done in the U.S., found that women in cohabiting relationships were 9 times more likely to be killed by their partner than women in marital relationships. So this is not a small difference. This is not a small thing. And again, these are quite robust results. You see these across a lot of situations and societies. Child abuse is a very important difference between marriage and cohabitation. It has to do with the treatment of children. This is a very recent study that was done in 2005. This was done in the journal called Pediatrics. And this was a thorough study of all the children who had died in the state of Missouri over a period of 3 years. And the children who resided in households with unrelated adults, were nearly 50 times as likely to die of inflicted injuries than child residing with two biological parents. Okay. Now, the unrelated adult, this is the key thing, because what this study was doing was, you know, looking at records. They were not like bugging people about who they're having sex with or whatever. I mean, they're just looking at who's in the household, what happens to the child. And if a child is living in a household with an unrelated adult, their risk of death from inflicted injury, that is somebody threw them down the stairs, somebody smacked them around, you know, not dying from leukemia or something, you know, but death from inflicted injury, 50 times more likely than children living with two biological parents. And it has sometimes been called the boyfriend problem. Okay, the boyfriend problem. Children in households, one of the very interesting things about this particular study is that children in households who had a single mom but no other adult in the household, they had no elevated risk of death at all. Okay, so it's some of the problems associated with single parenthood are not really the phenomenon of single parenthood per se, but the fact that the single moms have a boyfriend in the house who is not related to the child. That's the real underlying phenomenon. So if you have single parents, if the single moms would live like nuns for the rest of their lives, it wouldn't be so bad. But of course, most of them don't live like nuns for the rest of their lives. They have boyfriends who come and go, and those boyfriends present a particular hazard to the children. And as you can see from these other statistics, in the household with unrelated adults, most of the perpetrators were the unrelated household member. That's who was doing it, you know. And only 6.5% of perpetrators were the child's biological father. Now, I think the dynamic which gets going here inside these households is that in a cohabiting relationship, the child is not something that brings the couple together. The child is not a source of unity for the man and the woman. The child is an obstacle to what the man wants from the woman, right? The child's in the way of the relationship. And so therefore it's not a source of love or cooperation, it's a source of discord, it's a source of problem. And frequently what will happen, what you hear from the police reports and whatnot, is that the mom has gone off to work, she leaves the baby with the boyfriend gets frustrated, can't take it anymore, smacks the kid, drops him on the head, whatever, because that boyfriend does not care about that child the way the child's father would care about it, the way even her husband would care about it. And I should mention this, although this study doesn't particularly highlight this, I'll just mention that many studies of this phenomenon for whether it's child abuse or other kinds of indicators of child well-being, most studies rank the households in this way. Children are best off with their two biological parents married to each other. The worst, is mom living with a cohabiting boyfriend. Okay, in other words, unmarried stepfamily is what it's technically called. Okay, so there's no biological relationship, no married relationship. It's the two cases in between which are interesting. For many purposes, the stepfather, the married stepfather, who is not the biological father, actually is better for the child than the bio parent who are living in a non-married relationship. Okay? Not for all purposes, but for the child abuse stuff, that's a very common finding to find that. There are some indicators of emotional well-being where that's not true, but it's very interesting to see that in so many studies, marriage trumps biology. Marriage trumps genetics. Why? I think it's because the commitment of the man to the mother is the way in which men quite often really relate to their own children, right? If the relationship between mom and dad breaks down, often the relationship between dad and children breaks down. Often that relationship is mediated through the relationship with the mother. So if there's marriage, the father relates better in some respects to the children. Not in all, and we can talk about that in questions if you'd like. Now, next myth. Myth, marriage is an emotional trap. Well, that's interesting. Compared to what? Because the fact is that cohabitors report lower levels of happiness, lower levels of sexual exclusivity, less sexual satisfaction, greater uncertainty about the relationship, and poorer relationship with their own parents. Cohabiting couples are worse off in all of these measures than are married couples. Okay? I'm particularly interested in, especially when I go and give talks on college campuses, I always like to point out this one. Okay, that if you kids really want to have a good sex life, you need to get married and stop fooling around in your dorms, that married couples have the best sex lives, and this is a proven fact. Now, the issue of depression is that cohabiting women are more than 3 times more likely to be depressed than are married women. And this, again, this is a pretty robust finding, something that you see in a number of studies. And interestingly enough, if there are children present in the relationship, for the cohabiting woman, the children become an additional risk factor for increased depression, but that's not true for married mothers. Okay? So if you're a married woman with children, your children are a source of happiness to you. If you're a cohabiting woman, you're not married, and you have children, the children are kind of a source of stress and problem, additional problem to you. So that's something that shows up in the data, that cohabiting women, particularly cohabiting women with children, are more likely to be depressed. Next myth, marriage is too much financial responsibility. The reality is that marriage is a wealth-creating institution. And again, these are points which have been studied quite a bit. Cohabiting couples have about 2/3 of the income of married couples with children, that is similarly situated couples. And this is the key point, is this next one, that the average income of male cohabiting partners is about half of that of male married partners. Now, a lot of questions have been raised about this type of finding. Is it simply a selection effect? Is it the fact that more attractive, desirable guys tend to get married and therefore they have higher income? Or is there something about marriage that is harnessing men's ability to produce and is somehow encouraging them or somehow changing their behavior? And the answer is that there are elements of both. There is some selection effect, but it's also true that marriage is doing something. Marriage does something to men. It particularly does something to their productivity. And then finally, this last point I think is something most of us can relate to, which is that the private transfer of wealth, this is a nice social science term that means, will your parents give you any money? Okay? And the answer is, if you're shacked up with some schmuck, no way, right? But if you're married, they might, you know? And I think everybody can kind of understand what goes into that. But, you know, some guy went out and collected the data and can prove what your grandmother could have told you in her sleep. Okay. Now,